Hello, everyone. This is Dr. Erin Stair from bloomingwellness.com. Here we are. It's another episode of Causes or Cures. Vaccines. The new COVID-19 vaccines are on everybody's mind. As you know, the FDA just approved two vaccines for COVID-19 for emergency use. And people have a lot of concerns about them. People have a lot of theories in general. You know, I read all the comments on my Facebook health and wellness page, and sometimes I respond, sometimes I don't. Some, I think, are legitimate concerns. Some of the theories, you know, some are a little more creative than others. But, you know, my style is just to let it all out there, let people speak their concerns, even if they're crazy, and we can respond. We can address them head on. I don't believe in deleting comments or deleting what people have to say. You know that if you follow my Facebook page. So I did, though, take some of those concerns and turn them into questions, which I will ask my guest today. I'm super excited to have Dr. Andrew Fleming on the line. He is an infectious disease doctor right here in New York City. He has done research on antibody responses to COVID-19. He's very, very familiar with the vaccine trials. So we're going to chat about the new vaccines, what they actually do, what they don't do, the vaccines that are in development, right? Because there's still a lot that may see the light of day. We're going to talk about safety, effectiveness, long-term concerns, antibody-dependent enhancement, which was something I was concerned about. He's going to explain what that is, how long immunity will last after someone gets the vaccine, and, you know, how long it lasts if somebody gets infected with COVID-19 and recovers, because there's been a lot of talk about that. And he's going to talk about how long we will have to wear the face mask for. And I feel like I might have to add a trigger warning to that, because I know many people are frustrated by having to wear a face mask. I get it. I totally get it. But we are going to talk about face masks. So, I don't know, trigger warning, I guess. Okay, guys. So let's just jump on the call with Dr. Fleming. Here we go. So, Dr. Fleming, right? Am I saying that right?
Yes.
Okay. So thanks so much for doing this. And I was wondering if we could start maybe just like with a quick bio, kind of who you are and what you're doing now.
Sure. So I'm a physician. I live in New York City. And I'm currently a second year fellow in the infectious disease department at New York University. So I'm researching antibody responses to the virus that causes COVID-19. And I've also been involved in some of the COVID vaccine trials from Pfizer and AstraZeneca.
Perfect. So you are perfect for this. So obviously, like a lot of people who listen to this podcast, they don't have, extensive scientific backgrounds. And so I kept that in mind when I was trying to write the questions, and I try to simplify it as much as possible. So for all my listeners out there, I know we all know that every vaccine needs two things, an antigen or like a protein from the pathogen that is provided or generated by the person who gets the vaccine or the animal that gets the vaccine. Then there needs to be a response that signals the immune system to respond. Obviously there's different types of vaccines, and we have some new ones, the mRNA vaccines, which are Pfizer and Moderna. So I guess, since they're on everybody's mind, can you talk about, how those vaccines work, how they're made, and you know, what kind of ingredients are in them?
Yeah, sure. So, the basic idea of all vaccines is to give the immune system a preview of a pathogen, example, a virus, so that it learns to quickly recognize it. And then when it encounters that particular virus down the road, then it's well prepared and it can immediately start fighting it off. So a lot of vaccines, there's multiple different ways of doing this preview. Some of the classic vaccines use a weakened version of the virus or even a killed virus. And examples of that is most of our flu vaccines. Other vaccines, instead of presenting, you know, giving the actual virus, they just present a part of the virus to the immune system. For example, a protein that coats the surface of the virus. And then the immune system learns to recognize those protein markers on the surface of the virus. Our hepatitis B vaccines are examples of that type. So the mRNA vaccine takes the idea of that protein vaccine one step further. mRNA is the instructions sheet that tells the body how to build proteins. And so when you give an mRNA vaccine, you're injecting this, you know, instructions sheet essentially into the muscle in your arm, for instance. And the cells in your arm then pick up that instruction sheet and they start to build that designated protein. In the case of our COVID vaccines, that protein is called the spike protein. And so those cells, you know, start to produce this protein and then they transport it to the surface of their cells and they hold it up to the immune system and they say, hey, look, I found this foreign protein. And the immune system then learns to recognize it and creates a response. So, you know, the one key difference here to recognize is that, you know, the real coronavirus has lots of proteins in its genetic code. And all of those proteins kind of work together to wreak the havoc, you know, on our bodies and make us sick. This vaccine just contains that spike protein. So in that sense, it's not possible for the mRNA vaccines to give you COVID, so to speak. Unlike, you know, a flu, an inactivated or a attenuated flu vaccine, which in some people who are immunocompromised, they could actually get a mild form of the flu from the vaccine.
Okay, good to know. And I think when people hear, you know, when they hear RNA or DNA, they think of genes and the genetic code. And some people were like, okay, this thing's going in my cell. How is this not going to change my genetic code? And I'm sure you've seen that on the internet. So can you just talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. So the flow of information in cells always goes in one direction. mRNA gets translated into proteins, but it doesn't go in reverse. So mRNA can't get converted back into its precursor DNA. Our cells just don't have the machinery necessary to do that. Also mRNA actually never even gets into the nucleus of our cells where DNA is housed. So it's not possible for mRNA to get incorporated into our genetic code in that sense. And even if it did somehow, that piece of mRNA is a very simple instruction sheet. All it says, all it can do is tell the cells how to do one thing, and that's to build the spike proteins. The spike proteins themselves are not harmful. They're just, again, a marker of this virus.
Okay. And then the cell clears it out when it's done, right? It gets rid of the mRNA.
Right. Right. Okay. So our bodies have, tons of, enzymes that float around in mm-hmm. our cells and outside of our cells that chew up loose pieces of genetic material. That mRNA doesn't last very long. It's quickly, you know, translated and then it's, chewed up by our body's enzymes.
Right, right. Like lots of things are chewed up by our bodies. another type of vaccine that they're working on is a recombinant viral vectored vaccine. Sorry if I said that wrong. I think AstraZeneca is working on that, a couple other companies. So can you talk about that type of vaccine, how that would be made and how that would work?
Yeah, so the viral vector vaccine is similar to the mRNA vaccine that we were just talking about and that it also trains the immune system to recognize the spike protein. The process is a little bit different though. So the AstraZeneca vaccine uses a virus that is known to be harmless to humans. It's called a chimpanzee adenovirus, as a vehicle for that spike protein. So what AstraZeneca, in collaboration with Oxford University, have done is they've taken this chimpanzee adenovirus and they've engineered it so that it expresses the coronavirus spike protein on its surface. They've also engineered it so that it can't replicate. Essentially, they've deleted that portion of its genetic coding. So these are essentially just kind of impotent virus particles. They're like, you know, shells of a virus that are coded in this spike protein. So they're not capable of replicating or causing infection in us, but the immune system still identifies them as a potential threat and it produces antibodies against it. And the idea of using, you know, an inactive animal virus probably sounds scary to some people, but I think it's important to realize that our immune system deals with animal viruses all the time. This is not something new. And so, you know, we're exposed to animal viruses from our domestic companions, our dogs and cats, from livestock, even from wild animals. And those viruses are not adapted to harm us. And so our immune system clears them in 99.9% of cases, and we don't even know it. It's also important to know that this, you know, technology, the vector vaccine, has actually been around for a little bit of time. It's not a brand new technology. And it's been used in some other vaccines like the Ebola virus vaccines, and it was found to be safe in those cases.
Okay. And that's a great point. You know, we're exposed to these types of viruses all the time and we don't even know it really. We're not thinking about it. So does the viral vector, like the vehicle, so to speak, does it matter at all in terms of how our immune system responds? Is there any way that could be harmful to us, or are they making sure that it's not? Like, how can we be confident in that?
They have specifically chosen this vector, the adenovirus, because they, you know, have seen in lots of research data that it's not harmful to humans and that it produces a good immune response. And so that's why they've chosen it. And then they've taken these extra precautions of, you know, deleting the portion of the virus that allows it to replicate. Okay. So.
Okay. Yeah, that's important. So I've been reading a lot about, you know, in terms of creating an effective vaccine for COVID-19, you need not just a good antibody response, but a strong T cell response. And you're the expert here, so you can jump in at any time. Is that correct? And if so, can you explain why both responses are important and how they would evaluate that in a clinical trial?
Yeah, so traditionally, when we want to know how well a vaccine works, we look at the antibody response. That's because we know antibodies are a crucial tool in our immune system's repertoire for fighting off infections, but also antibodies are easily quantifiable. So we can get a sample of blood, we can measure that titer of antibody and say, okay, this person has a very high titer, they're probably, you know, protected. But in reality, our immune response to infections and to vaccines are very complex. They're more than just antibodies. And we've discovered that T cells, for instance, are really important in helping people fight off COVID infection. And they're probably important for maintaining immunity against COVID as well. And T cells have a lot of functions. You know, they're specialized cells in the immune system that some of them help to coordinate the response of immune cells. We call those T helper cells. They're kind of the quarterbacks of the immune response. Other types kill virally infected cells directly. We call those cytotoxic T cells. And we know that both types are important for clearing the virus. So after the infection resolves, then some of those T cells become what are known as memory T cells. And those T cells hang around for years and years. And if the virus ever returns, they can come back and quickly reactivate the immune system to fight off the virus. So once we discovered that T cells, you know, were important in COVID infections, we started looking at them in our vaccine participants as well. And what they found was that for both the mRNA vaccines and the adenovirus vector vaccines, both of them produced strong antibody responses as well as strong T cell responses. So when they measured the levels of T helper cells and cytotoxic T cells, they saw, you know, a big surge in those cells after vaccination. And that's an indicator that, you know, the immune response to these vaccines is multidimensional, and it's probably more similar to what would happen with a natural infection.
Okay. Okay. I also read about antibody dependent enhancement, and how that derailed past efforts to produce an effective coronavirus vaccine, which, and I know they've been working on a coronavirus vaccine for a long time. I think I've read about it related to some animal trials. I specifically remember ferrets. Is that a concern? And how would a vaccine make sure that doesn't happen, or that doesn't have to be a concern for people? And what is it? Like, what? I mean, that's really, like, what is it?
Yeah, it's, so let me take a step back and just kind of say, you know, describe antibodies, because that I think will help us conceptualize what's happening on the microscopic level. So antibodies are these, you know, Y-shaped molecules. They have these two sticky receptors on the ends of the Y that attached to very specific protein sequences. For example, you know, the receptor binding domain on a spike protein. So when antibodies bind to the spike protein, they block that receptor and they prevent the virus from docking onto our cells. So essentially, you know, they're preventing the virus from invading our cells. And that's, you know, one of the main reasons why they help us fight off these infections. They render these viruses kind of inert. But another function is that they also tag that viral particle for destruction by the immune system. So those tagged viral particles are then, you know, recognized by immune cells called macrophages, and those macrophages gobble up the viral particles and kind of digest them. And that's, you know, that clears the virus. So there's this phenomenon that we see in some viruses in the petri dish, where when antibodies are produced that are able to bind to the virus, but they're not potent enough to neutralize it, instead of helping to clear the virus, the antibodies actually allow the virus to infect those macrophage cells more easily, and they can end up causing a more severe form of the infection. So it only occurs, you know, in very certain types of viruses, for example, dengue virus. Essentially, it kind of throws off the immune response. And in that process, we call antibody-dependent enhancement, because it enhances the infection. So when the first SARS coronavirus emerged in 2005, that was the one that caused the very brief SARS epidemic. It was mainly outside of this country. But people started looking at vaccine candidates for that virus. And that virus is closely related to SARS-CoV-2, which is the virus that causes COVID-19. But it is different. And so some of the animal studies for the vaccines for the first SARS did raise concern that there was antibody-dependent enhancement going on. That was in, there were some mouse models and some primate models as well. However, it was just a handful of studies that showed that. So most of the studies did not show that concern.
Okay.
So is it possible this phenomenon could happen with vaccines for COVID-19? I think it's very unlikely for several reasons. The first is that a key feature of scientific research is reproducibility, right? You have to, if you do the same experiment, you should see the same result every time. And a few of these animal trials did show antibody-dependent enhancement, but not all of them did. So if this was an inherent feature of SARS-CoV, we would have expected to see it across the board. And again, this was in vaccine trials for the first SARS-CoV, not SARS-CoV-2, which is the virus we're dealing with now. A second reason is that antibody-dependent enhancement was seen when they were using inactivated viral vaccines. And those are different from the vaccines that we're using currently. So inactivated viral vaccines, the immune system produces a wide range of antibodies to different antigens on that virus. Mm. Some of those antibodies may be non-neutralizing, which means, you know, they can bind, but they are not powerful enough to neutralize or, you know, render that virus inert. And we know that those non-neutralizing antibodies are the ones that are concerning in disease right. like dengue. So our vaccines just contain a single viral antigen, the spike protein, and that's it. So when we look at antibody responses that people are getting from these vaccines, they're very highly specific and potent antibodies just to that spike protein.
Awesome, that was great, thank you. Very good explanation. Next question is, I suppose, more general. People often talk about adjuvants in vaccines. They say they're not well studied. It makes them nervous. Can you explain what they are and if there are any legitimate concerns about those being added to vaccines?
Yeah, so adjuvants are molecules which are included in vaccines to boost the immune response. The primary immune response to a vaccine is from the lymphocytes, the B cells and the T cells, which we talked about a little bit before. The innate immune system is another branch of our immune system, which includes things like macrophages. And the innate immune system is important because it helps to stimulate those lymphocytes and it helps create a stronger immune response. They're kind of like the hype team for the lymphocytes. Mm. So adjuvants are included because they specifically are recognized by the innate immune system, and therefore they help to really boost that response that you get, and that makes the protection that you get from the vaccine last much longer and, you know, be stronger. So, you know, adjuvants are includes several different types of molecules. Most commonly, they're salts like aluminum chloride. Those have been used for decades in vaccines, and you know their safety has been established over the course of you know 30 plus years, and also in people getting these adjuvants through billions of doses. Our current vaccines don't actually include any aluminum salts. I think the Pfizer vaccine does contain potassium chloride, which is a salt. It's similar to table salt. Some people even use it as a substitute when they have high sodium. But you know, I think it's also important not just to think of things in terms of their label as an adjuvant, but really to look at what the ingredients actually are. And so the full ingredient list for all of these vaccines, if you Google it, you can find it on the FDA Emergency Use Authorization Fact Sheet. So I would encourage people, if they're concerned, you know, you can find all the ingredients right there. Just, you know, make sure that you're looking at the FDA data and not just, you know, make sure you're vetting your source there. But yeah, these are powerful, you know, components to vaccines. They really help to boost the immune system, and they're needed in a lot of vaccines. They're not a big component of our current COVID-19 vaccines because these vaccines are so powerful on their own.
Okay. So are you confident that these vaccines can produce long-lasting immunity to COVID-19? Do you think boosters are going to be required in our future or recommended?
Yeah, I wouldn't say that I'm confident, but I would say that I'm optimistic. And I'm not confident because we frankly just don't know yet. The first doses of the Pfizer vaccine were given to people just 7 months ago, and the efficacy trials only started in July. So we only have about 3 months of data, but we can say that for at least 3 months, you know, people are seem to be well protected. You know, the Pfizer vaccine was over 95% effective. The Moderna vaccine was 94% effective. The AstraZeneca vaccine ranged from 65% to 90% efficacy. So we have some preliminary data that says these vaccines work well. How long that protection lasts is an open question because they just haven't been around long enough. But you know, the signals that we're seeing from our immune systems suggests that the protection will probably, you know, be good for at least 6 months, maybe longer. But I do imagine this is something, I imagine a future that's quite possible where people will have to get booster vaccines periodically if this virus hangs around.
Right. Is there any more thought on how long, you know, if you had the COVID-19 infection, the actual virus, you develop immunity? I know there's been so much chatter about how long antibodies last and whether or not people who had the virus and recovered should get the vaccine. Is there any sort of consensus on that?
So we know from the first SARS coronavirus that people had strong antibody responses that lasted for at least 3 years after they had the infection.
Wow.
So again, this coronavirus is closely related, but it is a different virus. But if our immune responses are similar to that, you know, we can expect that people will have, you know, antibody responses for some time. Again, antibody responses are not the entire picture. And those T cells are very important for long-lasting immunity, the memory T cells that we talked about. And those are much harder to measure. And so we don't actually have a good sense of that yet. But the fact that we are seeing good T cell responses up front suggests to me that that will probably, you know, provide longer lasting immunity.
Okay. So should they get the vaccine or shouldn't they? Should they wait? Or is that still kind of being sorted out?
Yeah. So people who've had the coronavirus can get infected again. We've seen that happen already. It's not common, but it is possible. And so, you know, if the coronavirus vaccine provides immunity to people who haven't gotten it, it makes sense that boosting the immune system with, you know, the vaccine will probably increase your immunity. So we're definitely, people who've had it are not excluded from getting the vaccine. And I think ultimately everyone should get the vaccine, including people who've had it. Some of the vaccine trials did include people who had antibodies previously from an infection. Hmm. And we saw that those people did not have, you know, more serious adverse events from the vaccine. In other words, they tolerated the vaccine just like everybody else, and they had good immune responses. So I fully expect those people will benefit from the vaccine as well.
I didn't know that. That's interesting. Now, are you at all concerned about this new mutant strand in the UK, in London,
Yeah, go ahead.
We're still gathering information about that, but you know, I think the virus does appear to be more transmissible than the virus that's currently circulating here in the United States. The good thing is that it doesn't seem to be more deadly, and so it causes the same, you know, severity of infection as our virus here. It's just another reason, you know, to be for everyone to really look towards getting protected, because this virus is going to be around for a long time, and really vaccination is one of the only ways that we can get rid of it.
So a lot of people are concerned. They say, well, this vaccine has been produced, you know, in like less than a year, 1 to 2 years. Usually it takes 10 to 15 years to produce a vaccine. Obviously we're in a pandemic, so there's a reason, you know, for that. But people are still hesitant because of that. Do they have any reasons to be concerned? Is that a legitimate concern at all for any reason?
I think it's helpful to explain, you know, why vaccine trials usually take 10 to 15 years. Developing a vaccine is very labor intensive, and it's a very expensive process. It costs millions and in some cases billions of dollars. So vaccine developers, you know, are businesses just like other companies. And so they like to spread out that process over time because it's less financial risk. So the process, you know, first you have preclinical animal trials. Right. If those look promising, then they do phase one trials, which are, you know, with a small number of healthy people to prove the vaccine is safe in humans. If that looks promising, then they move to phase two trials, which are, you know, a larger number of people of, you know, who are not necessarily perfectly healthy. You know, they may be older, they may have some various comorbidities. And, you know, that's to show that, you know, it's safe in people who are more similar to the people who are actually going to get the vaccine. And then if all of that looks good, then they proceed to the phase three trial, which is, you know, with thousands of people. And that's to look at the safety, but also the efficacy, how well the vaccine works. And after all of that is done, then the vaccine gets reviewed by the FDA. And then if they get, you know, approval from the FDA, then they start to mass produce it, and then they distribute it. So that process takes a really long time. Mm-hmm. And it makes sense because, you know, vaccine companies, they don't want to, you know, have a vaccine candidate turn out to be unsafe in phase two, and then have to, you know, scrap all of their phase three trials and go back to the drawing board. It makes sense to do it sequentially. And it definitely doesn't make sense to mass produce your vaccine before you even know if it's going to work. The big difference now is that the government has eliminated that financial risk. So the National Institutes of Health and the CDC have given these vaccine developers literally billions of dollars up front in the spring. And now they've purchased millions of doses of the vaccine. So they've taken that financial burden off of the vaccine developers. And so what that means is that, you know, Pfizer and AstraZeneca can roll out their studies across multiple states and even multiple countries all at the same time. That's much more expensive, but it allows them to get more participants and to reach their target enrollment much faster. And you can also, of course, mobilize lots more people to collect and analyze all of that data.
Right.
So the important thing is no one is skipping steps. No one has jumped from phase one to phase two without getting the green light from the FDA. What you may have seen, some of the trials are combining phase two and three. Mm-hmm. And phase two and three are not much different in terms of, you know, what the substance of the trial is. It's just different in the objectives that you're looking at. And so some developers like Pfizer have combined those, but it doesn't mean that the phase two and the phase three are occurring simultaneously. All it means is that they started with their phase two trial. They enrolled all of the number of people that they wanted to. They reviewed the safety data from the phase two trial that was given the go-ahead by the FDA. And then instead of just, you know, launching a new phase three trial, they just said, okay, let's keep monitoring those people from the phase two trial. And that's our efficacy.
Okay.
So Operation Warp Speed, I think, you know, has given people, unfortunately, this idea that the process is being rushed, but people are not skipping steps. It's really this massive investment which has allowed people to really be more efficient in the vaccine development process.
Which makes sense.
Yeah.
I mean, I know vaccine hesitancy has been increasing anyways before this. So this is just something, you know, that people who work in public health are going to have to communicate effectively to people so they understand it. But it's, vaccine hesitancy is an issue. I don't know.
I agree. And, you know, I would say it's hard when there's a lot of misinformation on the internet, but the beautiful thing about the scientific process is it's all very public and it's all transparent in this country. And so you can review the data from the vaccine trials yourself, and you can review the FDA's assessments. You can even, you know, sit in, or not virtually sit in, not physically, on the FDA's review of these vaccines. And so so if you really are concerned, you can get that information if you know where to look.
Okay, one final question, because I don't want to take up too much of your time. So a lot of people are upset when they hear that they're going to have to continue wearing their face masks even after they get vaccinated. There's an indefinite timeline there. So are they going to have to, you know, wear it for 1 month or 1 year? And they don't understand why. Like, why would they have to wear a face mask if they got the vaccine? So can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. So first of all, it is very important that people continue to wear masks even after they get vaccinated. And the reason is that masks do not just protect you from other people, they also protect other people from you. You know, they contain the droplets that you exhale and prevent you from spreading them to other people. The vaccine is very effective at preventing symptomatic COVID disease, but we know that it's not necessarily as effective at preventing people from carrying the virus around in their nose. And so even though you might be protected from developing the disease, you're not immune from carrying the virus in your nose and passing it to other people. So, and AstraZeneca actually looked at this, and they did see, you know, that some people did develop asymptomatic infections after getting the vaccine. That number was still much smaller than, you know, the placebo group who weren't getting a vaccine. So there's some benefit, but it's not 100%. And the important thing to realize is the scale of this pandemic is extraordinary. So we have 300 million people living in this country. Even if the vaccine is 95% effective, that still means 5% of people, you know, might get the infection, and a larger percentage may even transmit it to other people. So if everyone in the country gets vaccinated, which is a best case scenario, that's still 15 million people who could get the infection from the vaccine, or could get the infection after being vaccinated. So, you know, we're all trying to work together to defeat this pandemic, and we can't do it by ourselves. You know, we're really trying to reach that threshold of herd immunity, which is somewhere around 70% of the population who is immune to the virus. And so we need everyone who's capable of getting the vaccine to get it, because that's the only way that we're going to reach that herd immunity threshold.
So if you get the vaccine, it will prevent you from developing a serious infection, hopefully, of COVID-19, but you still might be able to spread it.
Exactly.
Okay. But that still might not be, I feel like that might be frustrating for a lot of people to hear, but right. So how long, I mean, is there a timeline? I mean, people don't want to hear that they're going to have to wear masks indefinitely. Mm-hmm. And I know that this is all obviously like people don't know because this is all new.
Yeah, I think it all depends on, you know, right now we have 2 approved vaccines.
Right.
We have enough, you know, to vaccinate, you know, a very small portion of the population. We definitely don't have enough right now to vaccinate 70% that we would need for herd immunity.
Okay.
More vaccines are in development, and the existing vaccines will continue to, you know, produce doses. So I think the timeline is a little bit hard to say right now because we just don't know all of the vaccine that's going to be available. And it depends on how many people decide to actually get vaccinated and when they can do that. Mm. So it's hard to put a timeline on it, but, you know, I would say I don't expect to be able to stop wearing a mask in 2021. I think most people are going to need to wear their masks through then. And, you know, nobody likes wearing a mask, but the more people who wear masks, the sooner we'll get through this. So if we keep doing the every man, woman for herself, we're not going to get out of this for years. If everyone gets the vaccine and we all wear our masks, we're going to get through this much sooner. So we're really all on this together and we have to cooperate.
Right. And I think people just, you know, it's just that level of uncertainty of not knowing, you know, things, and that's also going to change guidelines and recommendations, but it is a frustrating process, I think, for people who aren't kind of in it. Like, you're in it, but someone else who just, you know, wants to go out and hang out with their friends is like, what the heck? So yeah, it's an interesting time for sure. This is just a question I had. So do other vaccines, like, do they slow the spread though? Like, if I get the flu vaccine, am I, you know, is that the same thing in terms of I still might be able to spread it, or is this unique to COVID?
It's unique to respiratory viruses.
So, okay. Okay.
You know, and that's just because, we, you know, inhale virus and it goes into our respiratory tract and then it disseminates. And our vaccines protect us by giving us antibodies and T cells. Those things are in our blood.
Right.
So, the protection occurs after the virus has already entered our body. It just prevents it from, you know, escaping into the blood and infecting other organs.
Okay.
But it doesn't protect us from, you know, it doesn't prevent that virus from getting into the nose.
Okay.
So people have looked at vaccines that can give us IgA responses. IgA is a specific type of antibody that kind of sits on our mucous membranes in our nose. And people have tried that for things like the flu, and that does decrease, you know, people's ability to transmit the virus. But that hasn't been done yet for COVID. So that's something potentially on the horizon.
Okay. Well, thank you so much, Dr. Fleming, for your time. That was really informative. I learned a lot, and I'm sure you're super busy, so thanks for everything that you're doing just in your day-to-day. Yeah, absolutely. And I don't know if you're working over the holiday, but I hope you have a good holiday. And I really do appreciate you taking time out of your day to do this.
Thank you. Yeah, you know, it's an exciting moment for people in my field because, you know, we've put in all this hard work and now we're seeing that come to fruition. So
sure.
I'm happy to, you know, help share this good news and give people information so that they know what they're dealing with. I'm going to actually go get my own vaccine at 3:00 today.
Oh, so nice.
Yeah.
Okay, well, well, good luck with all of that. And thanks again. Take care.
Thanks, you too.
Okay, bye-bye.
All right, bye.
All right, guys, thanks so much for listening. I hope you subscribe. I hope you share this. Stick around. I always try to line up interesting guests. I love taking suggestions for topics and guests too. So always let me know if you have one. Thank you to Dr. Fleming. I thought that was great. I thought he gave some great explanations that were easy to understand. And that's important to me for this podcast to be easy for, you know, people who don't have scientific backgrounds to understand, because science is complicated. And so it's important to break things down. I always say, like, if I was listening to a podcast on how to fix a truck or a car, you would need to talk to me like I don't know anything, right? Like, kind of like you're talking to a dummy. That's how you learn. You make it real simple. And then you start to build, you know, on the foundation, but you have to make sure you understand it before you go run out there in the world, you know, talking about it. Anyways, that was an aside. There's always one or two of those in my podcast, as you know. Okay, so some of you might have comments and questions after listening to that. I expect many of you do. Some of you may have strong feelings. But you know, hey, feel free to post them on my Facebook wellness page. That's pretty much where I've been doing most of, you know, my health discussions lately. I do use Instagram, but I find it tedious to type out things, you know, on my phone. I'd rather use my laptop, and I think they got rid of the edit function too. So, as soon as I post a comment, somebody comes in and corrects my grammar. And I'm like, yeah, I was speaking that into my phone. That's why it did that. But, you know, then it just takes away from the whole point of the conversation. And Twitter is very political. And I don't like that 140 characters limit, because I feel like it's a fight to be clever. It's like Tetris with words. And I just don't want to do that. So I do like the Facebook platform better for discussions. And I know some of you don't like Facebook, whatever. Okay, I'm going off on a lot of tangents right now, but I hope you guys did enjoy that. Share it, subscribe, and tell me what you thought of it on my Facebook wellness page. That's a truck in the background. Do you hear it? New York City, even though it's emptied out, still loud. All right, guys, go and have a good holiday season with your friends and family and pets, which are family. Wow, I am really, really just going on today. Okay, that's it, guys. Bye.